This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Barack Obama talks about race. Hillary Clinton releases papers related to her time as First Lady. John McCain mixes up his Sunnis with his Shias. Florida says it won't hold a revote. And on the fifth anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, we'll talk with Iraq War veterans running for political office. It's Wednesday and time for a supersized edition of the Political Junkie.
There you go again.
My name is Geraldine Ferraro.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
I'm John Kerry, and I'm reporting for duty.
But I'm the decider.
Every Wednesday, NPR political editor Ken Rudin joins us for the latest on the presidential race and other political news, and there is a lot to digest this week. We'll talk about Senator Obama's speech about his former pastor and race in America, find out what, if anything, can be found in the 11,000 pages of former First Lady Hillary Clinton's daily schedule. Democrats in Florida and Michigan still don't know if their delegates will be seated at the convention this summer. John McCain messes up on a trip to Iraq, and New York's newly installed governor admits to extramarital affairs. Later in the program, we'll focus on the white vote in the Democratic Party and why it's splitting the way it is. And we'll talk with war veterans from both parties who are running for Congress. How much does their experience play into their campaigns? But first, we'll catch up on the week's political news. If you want to jump into the conversation on Obama's speech and McCain's mix-up, the number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Ken Rudin joins us here in Studio 3A. Hey, Ken.
Hi, Neil.
And there's a trivia question this week.
Well, there is. David Paterson, of course, is not only the first African-American governor of New York, but he's also the first legally blind governor of New York and actually the second legally blind governor in history. And the question is, who was the first?
And if you think you know the answer, give us a call, 800-989-8255, or zap us an email, talk@npr.org. And beginning with the newly installed governor of New York, why does his admission of apparently several affairs go to page A17 when his predecessor's affair with a prostitute has been front page news for 2 weeks?
Well, I can't believe we're leading with this, but I guess one of the reasons is that Elliot Spitzer campaigned on getting vice out of government. I think having an affair having his wife having affairs, I think that's nobody's business but their own. And perhaps maybe David Paterson wanted to bring it out early so he wouldn't be hounded by it in his first days as New York's 55th governor. But Elliot Spitzer, being the holier than thou, former prosecutor, former state attorney general, who prosecuted and sent to jail people involved in prostitution rings, I think that the word hypocrisy played a big part of that.
Also, one was uncovered by a newspaper, and the other one was admitted at a news conference.
That's true.
Getting out in front of a story. But anyway, clearly the big news, political news of the week, was yesterday's speech by Senator Obama, a speech he really had to make.
He did. You know, once upon a time, we talked about the fact that he transcended race, that he would rather not talk about being African-American. But given the comments by Geraldine Ferraro and the Geraldine Ferraros of the world, who say that Barack Obama got where he is only because he's black, and given the statements by Obama's pastor, Jeremiah Wright, the video was all over the evening news and YouTube, and, you know, very incendiary and inflammatory remarks. And, you know, the kind of remarks that would jeopardize Obama's attempt to form this biracial coalition if he was going to be the Democratic nominee and become the next president. So he had to act. Some people said maybe he waited too late. But look, the point is, I think that not only was this about Obama's candidacy, but the state of race relations in the country. And given the fact that Obama has a foot in both the white and black camps, I think it was a pretty remarkable speech, a pretty amazing speech. I thought yesterday's Talk of the Nation show was just incredible, just listening to all the opinions. And of course, look, ultimately, if we're talking about the political impact on this, the answer is the jury's still out. I mean, does it win over white ethnics in Pennsylvania on April 22nd? Perhaps not. Does it change the dynamic of the race? Perhaps not. But no longer can we look at Barack Obama as anything but a candidate where race is clearly a big factor.
We'll get some calls in on this, but one question has to be a remarkable speech by everybody's estimation. I think people criticize it, as you say, but that's going to be no matter where or when you make it. An amazing speech delivered at 11:30 in the morning on a Tuesday?
Well, that may be true, but if somebody just said they walked by the TV sets, at NPR and all three networks had pictures of Barack Obama on it. The evening news led with it. The front page of every newspaper in the country talked about it. So if people didn't see it live at 11 a.m. Eastern time yesterday, they certainly read about it this morning.
And something like 1.2 million hits on YouTube, so they can get to see it if they want to. Let's see if we can get some callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Elizabeth is with us. Elizabeth calling from Detroit.
Hi.
I
guess I'm really frustrated that there seems to be this insistence to talk about race, but I have to say I think he did a stellar job. He opened up the possibility for the nation to have a conversation about it instead of this diatribe and hurling things back and forth. And I hope that we'll have that conversation and not treat it, as he said, like a spectacle.
A diversion, I think, was his...
He named several things, but one of them, a diversion, a spectacle, and it's really frustrating that people insist on having this conversation, but I have to say I think he did a beautiful job of stating what a lot of people believe and a lot of people feel. And if you want to talk about it, then let's talk about it. And I also want to add that the newspapers... a lot of the analysis of this has spun this as though it's some kind of political tack that he's taking. And I find that hugely frustrating.
Well, it clearly was, to some degree, a tactical political response to the allegations, or not allegations, but the clips of what his former pastor said. And the question, therefore, you've known this man for a long time, Senator Obama, do you endorse what he says?
And he said that he didn't endorse what he said. He said that a long time ago.
But how do you then continue your relationship with him? It is a valid question, I think. Ken, would you agree?
Well, yes, but you know the frustration about talking about race. But as Barack Obama said in the speech, it's 50 years since the Brown decision. We still have segregated schools. We still have whites being paid more than blacks. We still have tons of inequities in this country. So while we're saying why should we be talking about race, clearly we have not talked about race in an honest way. And you know it's interesting. The last time you think of a presidential candidate speaking in Philadelphia, it was Ronald Reagan in Philadelphia, Mississippi in 1980, not to draw the contrast there. But this is a speech that I think that was pretty courageous for a presidential candidate to deliver, given the fact that there were so many questions about his past. Because we don't know really much about Barack Obama. And if what we do know about him is a Jeremiah Wright excerpt from speeches, then obviously it was a speech that he had to give.
Well, the speech it's most often been compared to was John Kennedy's speech in Houston, Texas, to Protestant ministers when he had to address the Catholic question.
Right. And of course, we assume it worked because he was elected president. Now, of course, he was elected by only 100,000 votes. Had John F. Kennedy lost, maybe we would make the argument that he did not. It was not a success. So I think ultimately we won't know if this is a success or not if and when Barack Obama gets the nomination.
Okay.
Well, if I might add one more thing, I'd say that it's even more important than that because if this conversation, if his speech can start a mature, honest dialogue and about race, and if white people can stand to hear that there is this bitterness and this anger in the black community, in various parts of the black community that gets expressed various ways, if they can hear that and discuss it, and if people in other communities can hear the frustration that he acknowledged that white people, certain segments of the white population have, then we can discuss it like adults instead of this thing that's so incendiary that's almost like a third rail or something.
Okay. Elizabeth, thanks very much for the call.
Sure.
I think we all agree that this is far bigger than just Barack Obama's presidential candidacy.
And indeed, he made it much bigger with that remarkable speech yesterday. And here is a trivia answer from Rhoda in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I believe the first legally blind governor in the U.S. was Governor Stacy of Pennsylvania.
I can't even remember a Governor Stacy of Pennsylvania. I know there was a Stacy who ran for lieutenant governor. I don't believe he was ever elected governor, but no, that is not the answer.
All right. Well, let's see if Roy has the answer. And Roy is calling us from Coventry in Rhode Island.
Hi, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I don't know the person's name, but was he a lieutenant governor from Arkansas?
He was from Arkansas. I think we both have the same accent. It was Bob Riley in 1975, after Governor Dale Bumpers resigned his governorship to become a senator, and before David Pryor, the new governor, was sworn in. Bob Riley was a Democratic lieutenant governor of Arkansas who was served governor for 11 days. He's the first legally blind governor in the country.
And I should say, emailer Karama had both the lieutenant governor and the name Bob Cowley Riley. Okay. So. Okay. Middle name, too. Thanks very much for the call, Roy.
Oh, my pleasure.
Bye-bye. Before we move on, there is Senator McCain said on a visit to Jordan and Iraq, first on Monday, I guess, in a phone call with a talk show back here, and then in a news conference in Baghdad on Tuesday, said three times that the Iranians are training al-Qaeda and sending them back into Iraq until Joe Lieberman leaned over and whispered in his ear.
Reminds me of when Nancy Reagan whispered to Ronald Reagan, "We're doing the best we can." And then he repeated it. What's interesting, this is more than just a little oops here, because John McCain has sold his candidacy as for his acknowledgement, for his expertise and gravitas in foreign policy, deriding Democrats like Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. And here he is in Iraq, talking about the fact that al-Qaeda, which is Sunni. Being supported by Iran, which is Shiite, which of course is not true. And Joe Lieberman reminded of that. It's an important gaffe, and you wonder about, when the Republicans criticize and mock the Democrats for their lack of expertise, I'm certain that the Democrats will throw this back at John McCain's face.
Senator Obama already did today in a speech, and as you say, it's likely to come up again. But other people are making the argument, if Senator Obama or Senator Clinton had made this remark, they'd be crucified as, there they are, naive.
Well, again, this was John McCain's strength, alleged strength. Obviously, he doesn't have as much gravitas on economic issues as he does on foreign policy issues. I don't know how long this will last, but it certainly was an embarrassment.
Well, stay with us. Ken Rudin is with us. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Matt Bai, who covers politics for the New York Times Magazine and has been a regular guest on this program several times anyway. And we're going to be talking about the white vote and why it splits the way it does in the Democratic primary, with Senator Obama winning the majority of white votes in small, rural, mostly white states, but losing the white vote in more urbanized, bigger states. How come? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us talk@npr.org and stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's Wednesday. That means it's Political Junkie Day. The race for the Democratic presidential nomination is airtight. Senators Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are in a delegate deadlock, but the vote breaks down in some interesting ways. Senator Obama does best in areas that either have a large concentration of black voters or, like Iowa, hardly any at all. We're going to talk with New York Times Magazine writer Matt Bai about what the numbers suggest in just a moment. Also with us is NPR's political editor Ken Rudin. We want to hear from you. How does the white vote break down where you live? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Matt Bai is a political writer for the New York Times Magazine, and he's with us here in Studio 3A. Matt, good to talk to you again.
Good to be back, Neil.
Now, in your piece on Sunday, interestingly, before Barack Obama's interesting speech yesterday.
Yeah, very interesting.
You said that white voters in mostly urbanized areas are clearly not as enthusiastic about Senator Obama.
Right, well, there's a strange breakdown, and at this point it's really, I think, too pronounced to ignore. It's a pattern, which is that, as you say, he does very, very well with white voters in rural, overwhelmingly white states.
Iowa, Vermont,
Wisconsin, the states you've mentioned, North Dakota, Idaho, go on and on. And then he does rather poorly or has a more difficult time in urbanized states or states where there's a lot of racial diversity, such as New Jersey or Tennessee or Ohio, Missouri.
And you're obviously leaving out Illinois, which is his home state.
Is his home state, so it's a little bit different. And there are anomalous. This is not across the board. You can pick out anomalous exceptions to this. But what certainly seems to happen is that in places with very small concentrations of black voters or very high concentrations of black voters, that is urban counties, counties where you'd expect where you'd expect a very heavy African American turnout. He does quite well, but in states where the population is decidedly racially mixed, where there's some amount of black voters, but it's neither overwhelming nor tiny, he's had a very hard time winning those states.
And why do you think?
Well, that's a question that people with more degrees than I will be pouring over for many years, I suspect. But there are several possible explanations. Certainly, in a lot of these rural states, they're caucusing rather than doing primaries, and his campaign has excelled at that. There could be an added bonus for Senator Clinton in states where the economy, in industrial states where the economy is an especially big issue, because she has a very pragmatic economic message.
Ohio, for example.
Ohio is an excellent example. But I think she has a tougher time with some of the activist base in some of these rural states, too, where you have fewer Democrats and they're more the diehards. That's also a possibility. But I think, what I've raised is the possibility there's something else going on, which is that in places where you have more racial diversity, where you have people of different races sharing facilities, sharing public transportation, sharing workplaces, you actually have less racial trust and less transcendence of racial issues. There's an interesting study by the sociologist Robert Putnam at Harvard and some others, which was written about in the magazine last year, which said that basically found that people in more diverse areas are just less trusting in general of everybody, mm-hmm. of all races. And so it might not be surprising to find that in a state like Ohio or New Jersey or New York or wherever, that you would find people have actually are less susceptible to the argument that you can transcend racial differences because they live with those differences every day. Where in a state like Vermont, people might be more willing to believe in a notion of a different kind of America with less racial friction because they don't experience it.
And interestingly, that group you're talking about seemed to be one of the audiences he was addressing in that speech yesterday.
Yes, I think so. I think it's not just. It's not just the situation with his pastor that created this environment where he felt he needed to address the race issue. It is the pattern that he has, the demographic pattern that he's been following as a candidate, the fact that he has not won the big urbanized states. This is now the crux of Senator Clinton's argument. She's not going to overtake him in delegates, but she is going to say to the superdelegates, in all likelihood, we've won the states that matter. We've won the big states, the mixed states. And so he does, in a sense, have to address this larger issue of is he meeting a racial barrier? Because if he is, and Democrats believe he is, then there's no reason to suspect he won't meet the same barrier in a more pronounced way as a nominee in November.
Let's get some callers in on this conversation. Again, 800-989-8255. Let's start with Kathy. Kathy with us from Westerly in Rhode Island.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi. I just want to make a comment that I read an editorial a while back that speaking to Barack Obama winning the white vote in Iowa. And they thought that perhaps there it was not so much the fact that Iowans suddenly were willing to vote for a black man, but it might be more that they just could not bring themselves to vote for a woman. And I'll take my comment offline.
Okay, Kathy. Thanks very much for the call. Do you think that plays a factor, Matt?
Well, let me say to Kathy that my very first reporting assignment for a professional newspaper was in Westerly, Rhode Island, as an intern for the Providence Journal. So I love the place. I have very fond memories. That is one of the theories out there that there's a misogyny that goes on that's sort of dueling with the racism, and that in a lot of places where in a lot of these rural states, they're more likely to vote for a black man than they are for a woman. I don't know, obviously. I haven't neither polled it nor, and I don't think any poll is going to tell you that. I don't find that a terribly persuasive argument because I think women have in general come further faster in American politics than African Americans have. And, for all the irony of Geraldine Ferraro's comments, he wouldn't be here if he weren't black, because she was on the ticket in 1984 and would not have been on the ticket had she not been a woman. And so I think that, that in itself is a demonstration that women have, generally found more profile in American politics than African Americans have, and that has to reflect an acceptance among American voters.
Let's go to April, and April's with us from Austin, Texas.
Hi, I just have a story to share. I am a minister in the Central Texas area, and I was visiting a family in the east from Austin, and I bring that up as Eastern because the eastern portion of our state has a tradition of having had slaves, et cetera. Anyway, I was taking care of a family, and the gentleman that I was helping out is in his 80s, we were watching television, and Hillary Clinton came on, and he started in with how he couldn't stand her and how he hated the Clintons. So I don't think he was bashing her because she was a woman, but he was bashing her because she was a Clinton. And then he paused for a moment, and he said, now, you know, please pardon the expression.
Be very careful with that expression.
Well, I'm going to be very careful in the way I say it. He said, now, who is that N-word man that is running for president? And mind you, this is before Iowa. This is back in the fall. And my job as a chaplain is not to correct people, really. But I said, oh, you mean the black man named Barack Obama? And he said, yes, that's who I'm voting for.
Well, that's an interesting story, April.
Well, it sort of blew me away.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
As we're dealing with these issues that Senator Obama mentioned yesterday in his speech about race in America and these attitudes, that man could have been, may have known his grandmother.
Well, there's a generational component to this, too. And I think Obama said something more interesting in the speech yesterday than I've heard people discussing. We had a caller earlier in the program who was talking about, now maybe we can have a conversation about all the resentments people have. I heard him saying something slightly different, which was, yes, there are all these resentments, but you know what? It's better than you think it is, which is very rare for a Democrat to say, because Democrats have been campaigning for 30, 40 years on racial justice, on the idea that there is all of this injustice and hatred out there that has to be addressed. And Obama actually said, he did not say, you know, I'm the guy who can overcome all these deep and divisive resentments. What he actually said was, these barriers are tumbling down already. And the political establishment simply hasn't caught up to it, that actually the country is changing, and you have to believe that the country is changing. That, to me, is a very significant argument. You've not heard that in Democratic politics or in American politics, and I think it is partly a reflection of the generational difference and the fact that he hasn't been in Washington for decades. And I happen to believe, having traveled the country for as long as I have covering national politics, that there's something to that, that actually the country is less divided, in a sense, on these issues, particularly younger Americans, than you would believe listening to the debate among those who've argued this issue in Washington for many, many years.
And interestingly, indirectly saying the traditional black leadership is also not in touch.
Yes. I mean, he was effectively saying this is not as divisive to Americans as you think it is. I can be elected. I can get things done. I can change this culture because people are ready. Not because I'm so transcendent, but because people are ready. And I think that's a very interesting and important argument to debate.
Here's an email from Pat in Belleville, Illinois. It's not that hard. Iowa, Vermont, he could get out and see a lot of people. They got over their concern about that black guy. In large states, he could not get to as many people. It's a matter of personal contact.
That's also a pretty good explanation. I wouldn't dismiss that. I think that's a really good point. He certainly has spent a lot of time in a lot of these urban states and a lot of time in big media markets. It's not the same thing as going door to door for months in a place. At the same time, that doesn't exactly explain how he does pretty well in white rural states where he spent very little time
caucus states.
Certainly didn't spend much time in North Dakota or Idaho or Vermont or Wisconsin or wherever. And, you know, in those states, he did exceptionally well with white voters. So, again, it's certainly likely a contributory influence.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the next question is, our next big contest is in Pennsylvania, a state that seems to be a lot more like, say, Ohio than it is like, say, Colorado.
Much more like Ohio, and you see Senator Clinton has kept a very steady lead in the polls in Pennsylvania. I think it would be very, very difficult for Senator Obama to win there. James Carville once famously described Pennsylvania as Pittsburgh and Philadelphia with Alabama in between, and it is a state with tremendous contrast in the urban areas and the rural areas. It is the kind of state that Senator Obama's had a very difficult time winning.
And another question following on from yesterday's speech, is that going to be effective in taking his message to the kind of white voters who he's had difficulty reaching before?
Is what going to be effective?
His speech yesterday.
I think it's obviously too early to tell. I think that the more he addresses it and talks about it and, you know, people feel, has he cleared that barrier? Has he made a case that people can accept? It probably helps him to some extent. I think his comments on the pastor, on his pastor were probably helpful for the reason that I think people do generally respect your standing up and saying that that person's my friend. I don't think voters, my personal feeling, I don't think voters hold you accountable for everything everybody you know mm-hmm. or trust or have in your life says. I do think they want to see some loyalty and some conviction. And so I think he probably helped himself yesterday with suspicious voters by saying not just that the comments were wrong, which he'd said before, but also this is a guy I'm not going to throw under a bus. He's been in my life for decades, and you know I'm not going to stand here and denounce him as a human being.
Let's get Chandra on the line. Chandra's calling us from Traverse City in Michigan.
Hi. I'd like to say that I dated a guy in high school who was half black and half white. His friends called him a zebra. He didn't know where he fit in. He didn't know if he was a black man or a white man. And I think Obama has done a lot of good exploring his roots, and I think that's great. I think that from what I hear from my friends here, if he can show that he's embraced his whiteness and his worldliness as much as his blackness, I think that he'll be able to pick up a lot more of those votes, especially in urban areas. I don't think he sees himself as just a member of a black community, but a member of the world community.
And Matt Bahe, he's certainly taking a great deal of care not to be cast as the black candidate.
Yes, I think that's true. And I think, unfortunately for him, and for African Americans in public life, it's the public that decides, right, whether you're black or not, or whether you know, to the public you're just black, and the mixed lineage, probably has less to do with it. But I do think that every day he's stuck talking about this is by and large a bad day for him, because as Chandra says, he doesn't want to be the black candidate. This is a guy who has every claim to run as a candidate of a new generation with a new message. He doesn't want to be running. Yeah, he's tried not to be pigeonholed that way. The Clintons at various times have tried to say or imply at least that he is the candidate of black voters in black America, because that is a surefire way historically in the Democratic Party to marginalize him. And so every day he has to try and get out of that box is a day where he is not getting across the things he wants to get across.
Chandra, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're talking with political junkie Ken Rudin and Matt Bahe, the New York Times Magazine, about how the white vote has been breaking down in the Democratic primary in the presidential race. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Matt, as long as we've got you here, why don't we go through the next couple of months? Pennsylvania obviously comes up next. If Hillary Clinton's going to, she has to win Pennsylvania.
Yes, and all appearances are that she will. I mean, it's early, and the history here is that Senator Obama generally surges when he's in a state for a while, and mm-hmm. All of these races have been close. She's not maintained that kind of lead anywhere, but she's certainly got a better than average shot of winning in Pennsylvania.
And from after that, you go into there's a few states left. I guess North Carolina being the biggest of them.
North Carolina,
and again,
biggest.
That should probably be Obama country.
Should be. Again, none of these have been easy, but it's got a large African-American voting bloc, and he's done, he did very well in South Carolina. So certainly hopes to be competitive in North Carolina. I think the larger story here is she's not likely to catch him in delegates. They're going to split these delegates. This is the history of the way this race has gone and the way the Democratic Party apportions delegates, is that no matter who wins in these states, there's going to be some image to come out of it. But the overall delegate count is probably going to remain pretty steady. It's hard mm-hmm. for her to overtake him. And then the question is, how long does this go on, and what do the superdelegates do? Do they all sort of decide en masse that they just honor what the pledged delegates have done, which is not at all why they were created? They were actually created for the opposite purpose, to thwart the will of the voters
right.
if necessary. Or does it become sort of a bargaining table for all these superdelegates? I personally would not be at all surprised to see it go to the convention. I think that's very likely, because once you get into this realm of asking superdelegates for their votes, you're going to have bribes and begging and all kinds of deals cut. And these guys are pros. They're going to want to extract the maximum leverage they can, and that's going to mean waiting to the last possible minute to make a decision.
And I guess a lot, the other question that plays into this is Florida and Michigan.
Big question. It's a big question, and it is a mess. And I think, I think it's going to dawn on everybody that the one thing they really need to avoid as a party are the camera banks trained on empty seating sections in, Michigan and Florida during the time of the Democratic convention when they want to be talking about inclusivity and expanding the electoral map. That's a real problem. At the same time, I think, you can't just throw those delegates back in. Look, they took a gamble. They took a gamble that actual delegates mattered less than being influential early in the process. They lost in that gamble. They flouted the rules. I think it's very, very hard to imagine.
Interestingly, have they not moved their dates? they would have both been huge.
Right. Well, there's the old rule of politics again. You know, stand where you are, and eventually the moment comes back to you. So they're going to have to come up with some kind of solution. It probably will entail some kind of cutting the number of delegates and apportioning them by some formula. They have until the end of June for the Rules and Bylaws Committee of the party to sort this out. After that, it goes to the Credentials Committee, which will be controlled at least nominally by the candidate who has the most delegates, which would seem to be Senator Obama at this point. So I think by the end of June, the party will try to hash out some kind of solution that will make exactly nobody happy.
And which is also explains why Senator Clinton is in Michigan today.
Yes. I mean, clearly they're going to – well, they know that these delegates aren't coming back in as they are, but they're going to get some mileage out of making the case over and over that this has been a flawed process and that delegates have been excluded, because she's not going to overtake them in the delegate count. And so the best argument is going to be any argument that justifies why superdelegates should discount the lead that he has. And so making the case now going forward that Florida and Michigan represent a huge flaw and inequity in the process is central to her case.
And very quickly, is this going to be like the end of a college basketball game? You're just trying to make the game longer? Foul, foul, foul. Just make the game longer and you might win. You never know.
It looks that way, yeah.
Matt Bai, thanks very much for being with us.
Anytime. Thanks, Nick.
Coming up even more, The Political Junkie on this fifth anniversary of the war in Iraq. We're going to look at veterans marching toward Congress. We'll talk with two veterans of the Iraq War who've made the transition to politics next. And of course, we want to hear from you. If there's a veteran on the ticket, other things being equal, would that sway your vote? Is the Iraq War the issue you vote on? It's the talk of the nation from NPR News. And political junkie Ken Rudin is with us. Today's the fifth anniversary of the war in Iraq. Several veterans of that war are now running for Congress. A little later, we'll talk with Congressman Patrick Murphy, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, currently the only Iraq War vet who serves in Congress. He's running for re-election. Ken Rudin is still with us, our political junkie. Of course, we want to hear from you. If there's a veteran running for office in your state, let us know how that might change your vote or not. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And joining us right now is Republican State Senator Steve Stivers, running for election to the U.S. Congress in Ohio's 15th District. He serves in the Ohio National Guard and was deployed to the Middle East, including Iraq, in 2005. Nice to have you on the program today.
Hi, Neil.
When you decided to run for office, you cited your military experience in your announcement. How much do you find yourself talking about your military background as you campaign?
Well, it depends who I'm talking to, Neil. Frankly, the issue that's top of mind for most voters right now is the economy and jobs in the state of Ohio. We've lost about 250,000 manufacturing jobs in the last 10 years, and we really need to make sure we stay focused on jobs and the economy. But clearly, national security is an issue, and I think we're better served by people who have the background of serving in the military, because they have perspective on the situation, and especially folks who have had boots on the ground in the Middle East.
Do you find that there's an element of the voters who are really passionate about the war, though?
There are people passionate about the war on both sides, for sure, in my district and throughout the country. There are people who are very passionately supportive of making sure that we give the soldiers everything they need, and that we there are some people who willing to stay till the bitter end, and there are some people out there who are clearly would love to withdraw today.
Mm-hmm. Your district is, well, about as close a district as there is anywhere in the country.
Correct. It was won by the current Congresswoman Deborah Price in re-election last year by about 1,000 votes.
And everybody expects it's going to be very close again.
It could clearly be close again.
As you look ahead to this, does your experience as a veteran play into your resume as, you know, obviously you're emphasizing it as part of your background and part of your experience?
It's clearly part of who I am. I've been in the National Guard 23 years. I'm a veteran, and we're going to have a lot of new young veterans coming home, and we need somebody who's been in their boots and knows what they need. We've got a lot of people coming back with traumatic brain injuries. We've got a lot of people coming back with very serious injuries that in previous conflicts they would have probably died from, but because of our health, our strong military medical services and all the protective gear that a lot of us wear, a lot of people live through things that they might not have lived through, but they clearly have shattered lives, and we need to look out for those folks. So having a veteran in Congress, I think, to look out for those folks is a positive thing, and we need more folks both Republicans and Democrats who are veterans in Congress.
How do you, you've seen, of course, I'm sure the same polls that everybody else sees, and I've probably even seen more detailed ones involving your district in particular. But nevertheless, the war, after 5 years, most Americans believe it was a mistake. Do you embrace the president? Do you support his policies, or do you distance yourself from him?
Well, Neil, I think that the war has, there have been a lot of mistakes in the way the war was prosecuted, and, you know, that is something that everybody understands. I think the surge is clearly working. I think that there are some positive things going on, but I think what we really need to do is look at America's national interest and say, going forward, you know, we can't drive looking in the rearview mirror. We've got to say, going forward, how do we look out for America's national interest, and what decisions can we make to make sure that we look out for our own interest in the Middle East? And clearly, I think if we were to withdraw today, it would cause a big problem toward our national interest, because Iran would probably move into the oil fields in southern Iraq that they fought over for 10 years with Iraq when Saddam Hussein was in power. And for us to just give that to Iran, who could be one of the most dangerous countries in the world right now, is a huge problem. And we have to figure out a way to bring our soldiers home in a thoughtful way and make sure that we allow the Iraqis to protect themselves and build up their own defenses, which they're clearly working on. That doesn't mean we should have our soldiers there for a long time. It means we need to plan it out and think it through and be smart about the way we bring our soldiers home.
Ken?
I have two questions here. One, do you get a sense that the political dynamic has changed since 2006? I think one of the reasons the Republican Party lost control of Congress in 2006 was because of the Iraq War and the response to it. And also, two, do you get a sense that having John McCain topping your ticket is a plus, or the converse way of asking the question, running against Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, does that help your party and your cause?
Thanks, Neil. I think the second question first, I don't think it matters who the Democratic nominee is. Clearly, the tone of the race will probably be different against the two potential Democratic nominees, but having John McCain at the top of our ticket, especially with regard to national defense and security issues, is about the best candidate we could possibly get. And if you want to look out for America's interest and make sure we have a strong America, John McCain has made a career of doing that. And with regard to the change since 2006, I think the real change since 2006 is the surge. And we've had a change in strategy, a change in military leadership over there from General Abizaid to General Petraeus, and a change in tactics over there. We have, when I was over there, spent most of my time in Kuwait, but I was also in Iraq. The big strategy was to pull the soldiers back into the base camps at night. And the problem with that is you left the civilian population at the sort of whim of the insurgents, and the insurgents in the evening could have their way with the civilian population and also lay improvised explosionary devices along the roads, because all our folks were essentially back in a safe zone inside the camps. General Petraeus has put the soldiers and Marines and the sailors and airmen out among the population, which means that the civilian population is now safer, and it also means that the insurgents don't have a free rein of operations in the evening. So clearly I think that the change in tactics and strategy, as well as the change in military leadership, has had a positive effect, and I think that's part of the reason that there's not a huge conversation about the war going on. It's, you know, to be a country at war and have it not be the one of the top issues among the way people are talking, part of that's because the surge is working. Part of that's because the economy has taken some tumbles, and there's other issues that have risen that clearly voters care about and should care about, because when their wallet's at stake, that's the first thing most people are going to care about.
Hmm. Here's an email we have from Kurt in Benton, Kentucky. As a former United States Marine Corps officer and U.S. Army National Guard member activated for First Desert Storm, I certainly think we need representation that understands problems associated with new veterans and their problems and the current political situations. A veteran running for office should be given more consideration than other candidates because of his or her experience. And we're asking callers and emailers to weigh in on that question. Here's Matt. Matt's on the line with us from Baltimore. Matt.
Hey, to the soldier, thank you very much for your service. It is breathtakingly courageous, and I think what you're doing is a good thing. I plan on going to law school to do veterans law, actually, so that for veterans coming home and having to fight the tight-fisted VA bureaucracy, I'm hoping to get in on that fight. But actually, I don't think that being a veteran necessarily makes you more qualified to be a politician, because what I look for in a politician is intelligence, abilities, and accordance with the issues. And I don't think that being a veteran really makes a difference in that respect. And also one more thing, I'd like to make a quick shout out to my public radio hero, Mark Steiner, out of Baltimore, and the entire city of Baltimore's thoughts are with him.
All right.
Thank you very much
for the call, Matt. A quick response to that, Mr. Stivers?
Well, I think I'm glad Matt is going into veterans law, because I think there are going to be a lot of struggles with veterans getting benefits, and certainly God bless him for that. I think that having the perspective of wearing boots with these fellow soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines does give you a unique perspective. I clearly agree with the caller that it's not everything, and you can't sell yourself just as a veteran. I'm one of the few people in this country that's had a chance to be a state legislator, as well as having a military background and having worked in private business, so I think I have some unique qualifications that prepare me for the challenges of the day, whether it's making sure we reinvigorate our economy or making sure that we look out for national defense issues.
Steve Stivers, good luck to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Neil. Appreciate it.
Steve Stivers, a Republican member of the Ohio State Senate, now running for election to the U.S. Congress in Ohio's 15th district, with us today from his office in Columbus. Joining us now in Pennsylvania is Democratic Congressman Patrick Murphy. He represents the 8th District of Pennsylvania, currently the only Iraq War veteran serving in Congress, running for re-election in November. Nice to have you back on the program.
Hey, Neil. Thanks for having me back again. I appreciate it, and it's great to be with you today.
Well, like Congressman Stivers, that was a very close district. Your district was you were a Democrat running in a district that had elected Republicans fairly regularly, and the Iraq War was seen as the issue that put you over the top. Is it still the issue this time around?
I think it's one of the most important issues, and I think it's the defining issue of our generation. And that's why, I do believe that's what helped us carry us over the top in a Republican-leaning district. As you said, there's 25,000 more Republicans and Democrats in my district, and we were able to win by the closest of margins, 0.6%, only 1,518 votes of the almost 250,000 votes casted back in 2006. But I believe that it's incumbent on our leaders in Washington, on our Congress, and our next president that we need to start bringing our troops home from Iraq.
Yet I'm sure the economy is a big issue also in Pennsylvania. It's State Senator Stiver said it was the issue in his district.
Well, I think it goes hand in glove, actually. In fact, when we spend $12.5 billion a month in Iraq, that takes a toll on our economy because it's a lot of spending. But when you look at why we're, one of the reasons why we're in the Middle East, Neil, is because we're addicted to foreign oil. And we send $25 billion a year to the Middle East, and we need to wean ourselves off that foreign oil. And we can do that by investing in green-collar manufacturing jobs right here in the United States, investing in wind energy and solar energy and conservation efforts. And, I just came back from a groundbreaking where in our little corner of America here in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, we've created the green energy hub of the whole East Coast. We just started constructing. The groundbreaking today was to construct the fourth largest solar panel field in the whole United States of America.
A lot of people don't even know the sun shines in Pennsylvania.
What's that, Neil?
It's that a lot of people don't even know the sun shines in Pennsylvania.
That's right. Well, today it's not really shining that brightly, Neil, to be honest with you.
A little rain.
Listen, it's not it's not snowing outside, so we can't complain.
We're talking with Congressman Patrick Murphy, a Democrat from Pennsylvania. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let me ask you, how has the reduction of violence in Iraq, the clear difference of the situation there on the ground from a year ago? A lot of people credit the surge for that improvement. There are other factors as well, the ceasefire by Muqtada al-Sadr and the so-called Sunni awakening. But nevertheless, the situation on the ground has changed since the last election.
We've put 30,000 more troops in the ground, and our troops are doing a wonderful job. But we can't deny the fact that 2007, Neil, was the bloodiest year of the 5 years we've been in Iraq. Almost 1,000 of our troops have given the ultimate sacrifice. And, our troops are doing a great job over there, but it does not change the fact that we have continued to take our eye off the ball in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is where al-Qaeda has been able to reconstitute themselves, where they are most strong, and where Osama bin Laden still is, and they're the ones that killed 3,000 innocent Americans on 9/11 of 2001. Mm-hmm. And they're not Osama bin Laden and senior al-Qaeda and where they're most strong in Iraq. And that's why we need to wean ourselves away, bring our troops home, a phased redeployment of our troops in Iraq, so it can refocus back on Afghanistan.
Dave is on the line with us. Dave calling us from Wareham in Massachusetts.
Yeah, good afternoon, Neil.
Afternoon.
Well, I was calling more about the previous caller, guest that you had. I'm not. He's a veteran. He's running. That's wonderful. I don't think that entitles him to any special things because he's a veteran. Yes, the Veterans Administration needs help because we're in a peacetime VA in a very tragic wartime. But there's a whole host of issues behind this war that I find be troubling, and the fact that right now the economy has gone down the toilet is much more important to me than this quote ultimate victory in Vietnam, because it's still going to be defined.
And would you have said that a year ago?
I've pretty much been that way since the war started. I'm a non-vet, but I didn't like the Vietnam War to begin with, and I think it's done nothing but destroy our military and our prestige internationally.
Well, Dave, thanks very much for the call.
Yes, sir.
And before we let you go, Congressman Murphy, how is when you're out on the stump talking to people, are the passions about the war as strong as they were when you last ran?
Oh, absolutely. We've had vigils all over Bucks County, northeast Philadelphia today in my district, and people care deeply about it. I mean, when you lose the most amount of troops this past year and you have, the Republican talking machine still making it sound like, everything's great, everything's wonderful, we're turning the corner, you have to say, listen, we lost almost 1,000 troops this past year, and the Iraqis, for the most part, are still sitting on the sidelines. It's still the American troops that are doing the heavy lifting. It's still the Shia government, Shia-led government in Iraq that keeps promising the Americans, oh, yeah, we'll work with the Sunnis, we'll share with the oil revenues. And they say it year after year after year, and they still refuse to do it. And that's why it's so important that we call for what I've called for, a 16-month timeline or some type of timeline to bring our troops home so we can secure our home front and refocus some of those troops over to Afghanistan, where al-Qaeda is most strong.
Congressman Murphy, thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks, Neil. Love to be on the show, and looking forward to seeing you soon. And thanks for the plug on our book, Taking the Hill, which is in bookstores all over America today.
Okay. Thanks very much, Congressman Patrick Murphy of Pennsylvania. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.